Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. It's August 24th, 2020, live, to be rebroadcast August 26th, 2020 on 91.7 FM WHUS Stores. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician, with my co-host Ron Meniza. During the pandemic, we are not broadcasting in the Yukon Student Union. Instead, we are broadcasting live from beautiful Mansfield Hollow, Connecticut, on Mondays at 10 o'clock a.m. on Facebook Live. Comment below to let us know you're here and ask questions. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, and Spotify. You can also check out my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at FranStorchND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. So we had a nice weekend this weekend.
We sure did.
Yeah, we went to Pennsylvania Dutch Country.
Yeah.
And we saw many, many, many buggies.
Yes, we did.
Because it was Sunday and everybody went to each other's houses for Sunday go to meeting.
Right.
They probably don't call it that. They went to each other's houses for church. And we learned a lot of stuff about the Pennsylvania Dutch, about Amish people, because we went to the Amish village and they taught us things. I learned that when you're a little baby, you basically wear a dress regardless of your gender. And then when you get a little bit older, you get a nicer dress. If you're a girl, you get a nice dress in a color that you like, but it has to be all solid, and you get a little pinafore, a little white pinafore with it. If you're a boy, you get pants, and you always wear suspenders. They don't wear belts. Then when you are a young woman and you're of marriage age, but you're not married yet, you get an older girl's dress. You also have a white pinafore over it. And then when you get married, you have a black pinafore, and you always have a prayer bonnet on, and the prayer bonnets are worn by the Amish everywhere, but the prayer bonnets that are worn in Lancaster County are shaped like a heart in the back, because Amish country in Lancaster County, that's the heart of the Amish, that there's about 40,000 Amish in Lancaster County. And that's the largest collection of Amish folks in the world. There are Amish people in other states, and we know there are Amish in Kentucky, and they're certainly in the Finger Lakes in New York, because we saw them there. And they go all the way up into Canada. I've seen them in Atlantic Canada. There are Mennonites in Atlantic Canada. So the difference between the Mennonites and the Amish, the movement was founded by Menon, a gentleman named Menon. And then there was a break off that they had different beliefs about how to practice. And right now the Mennonites, they are, I would say that they participate more in technology. The thing about Amish and technology is very interesting. They don't believe in being connected to the outside world. So that's why they don't have electricity. They don't participate in the power company, but they do have electricity. They will use batteries. They will use self-sustaining electrical devices, and they will power things with gas. So they have gas refrigerators and gas stoves, and they have LED lights, bright lights. Like when you see the carts have LED lights on them, and they have turn signals and everything.
They do.
And they have those big orange triangles so you don't hit them. We saw so many carts.
We're going to talk about that a little bit more later on today.
It was church weekend. And we saw so we saw loads of people out. We waved hello to them. And I was driving the chicken car for course support. And so I think the chicken car was fascinating, not just to the Amish, but to everybody who saw it. So anyway, it's good advertisement for Renegade. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so we had a nice weekend. And of course, when we traveled, we were very COVID safe. We didn't eat in any restaurants. We didn't even really get takeout because we were given food by the Farm to Fork folks. Yeah. And, we always wore masks and we always washed. And then when we were at our event, we were masked when we were off our bikes and we were sanitizing constantly. You know, I was core support. So, you know, every time before I touch anybody, it was like I was seeing a patient. I would do my hands before I would touch anybody or anything I was going to give to somebody. And then I had to transport a woman in my car, so I had all the windows down, and she sat catter-corner to me in the back, and we both masked. And then when I was done, when I let her go, I had to sanitize the car. So mm-hmm. We took extra precautions. It was nice. I mean, it was COVID nice. But it is a way to survive and actually participate in something during this time. And everybody's different in terms of the level of comfort they have with participating in regular everyday life. And to be honest, if I didn't have this event going on, I probably wouldn't travel as far as I had traveled. But But, you know, it was enjoyable, I must say. So, all right. So the topic of the week that I want to discuss is irritable bowel syndrome.
Oh, so, lovely.
Yeah. Because a lot of people have it. A lot of people suffer from it. And, you know, it has a lot of different symptoms to it. And you can have mostly constipation, mostly diarrhea, or a mix of the two. You can have gas and bloating. You could have anxiety and depression associated with it and sleep disturbance associated with it. And the rough percentage of people that suffer with it in the United States is somewhere between 3 and 20%. So I'm not sure why the spread there. The condition affects more women than men. Some people with IBS have minor symptoms, but for others, symptoms are significant. So I'm wondering why it would affect more women than men. I'm guessing that it has to do with our hormones, because when you and it has to do with our menstrual cycle, because during the menstrual cycle, especially as you get closer to menstruation, you release prostaglandins that help to start to contract your uterus so that you can release your menses. And the prostaglandins work on smooth muscle. So they work on the smooth muscle of your uterus to let go of your menstrual flow, but they are also effective on your bowel, on your small intestine. So women are going to definitely experience, that's why you get menstrual cramps. Your menstrual cramping can be pain of the uterus actually cramping, and it can also be intestinal cramps because those little prostaglandins, hormones, those localized hormones that you release to help your uterus to contract, also work on your small intestine, or sorry, your large intestine. And so you get digestive symptoms. And the digestive symptoms can be constipation, can be diarrhea, can be gas and bloating, can be either. So IBS has also been called spastic or irritable colon. Sometimes it's called mucus colitis and spastic colitis. And there isn't necessarily inflammation. It's not inflammatory bowel disease, and it's not necessarily related to other bowel conditions. In fact, it gets diagnosed when there's been an attempt to diagnose other conditions and you failed to diagnose those. So if you have a colonoscopy, what they do is they go inside and they have a scope and they look around and they take a sample of the inside of your colon and then they look at it under a microscope and they look to see what the shape of the cells are. And there will be characteristic inflammation if you have ulcerative colitis versus Crohn's disease. Those are both inflammatory bowel diseases. Those are autoimmune inflammatory bowel diseases. When you do that biopsy with someone who has irritable bowel syndrome, you'll see absolutely normal cells. They'll have all these symptoms and all the cells look terrific. They look just normal. So it's what's called a functional condition. The problem is not with the cells. It's with the function of the system. So when you have irritable bowel syndrome, it can vary and you can have symptoms. You can have ongoing symptoms. You can have symptoms all the time. You can have symptoms that last for a while and get better. You can have symptoms today, but not tomorrow. And it can really vary. It can cause intestinal damage in some cases, but that's unusual. And if it has intestinal damage, then you have to consider other conditions. And it doesn't increase your risk of cancer either. Inflammatory bowel disease does, but it certainly can affect your life, of course. Mm-hmm. So you can get really bad symptoms. You can get cramping, abdominal pain, bloating, gas, diarrhea, constipation. You can have alternating constipation, diarrhea. And some of your symptoms, often when you're symptomatic, if you go and you have a bowel movement, your symptoms get better. So in women, as I said, we tend to have symptoms around the time of menstruation or more symptoms at that time for the reasons I said, because you're releasing those prostaglandins and they tend to make your large intestine cramp. And men have the same symptoms, but fewer men report their symptoms and seek treatment. So what I wonder about that, that's really interesting.
Yeah, why is that? Men don't like to go to the doctor either.
No.
That's another thing.
Well, it's said here that more women suffer from irritable bowel syndrome than men.
I think it's because it's reported more.
That's what I was going to say.
That's where you're
at. I think maybe it's not true. Exactly, that men just suffer with it. that they just don't want to go to the doctor for it.
Right.
They think, well, I'm not bleeding. I'm not dying. Yeah, I've got some gut pain, but oh well.
Yeah, and they also tend to flatch. What's the word?
They have more flatulence.
In front of one another as a ha-ha thing.
They don't mind releasing their gas.
Yes, they don't. As a matter of fact, it's kind of a thing you do when you're with your buddies sometimes. But I don't do it anymore. But when I was younger, it was definitely a thing that was done.
It was funny.
It was funny.
Oh.
Right? It was part of bathroom humor.
All right.
Yes.
Awesome. Just
terrific.
Which I know
you absolutely love.
Yeah, it's terrific. So the pain often can be improved after a bowel movement. And you can have a change in how often you have bowel movements, and you can have different, your stools can appear differently. And so you get diagnosed, as I said, because you have a functional problem. You have these symptoms, gas, bloating, constipation, diarrhea, and you may have had a colonoscopy, and the colonoscopy is absolutely normal. And also you might have had a stool sample to rule out some kind of infection. If you ruled out celiac disease, you might get diagnosed with irritable bowel syndrome. So one of the things about irritable bowel syndrome is that, in the conventional medicine world, they have this diagnosis where if you don't have inflammatory bowel syndrome, you get diagnosed with this condition. And when you get into the naturopathic world, we get a little bit more specific with it because we know that people tend to eat foods that don't work for them for a variety of reasons. And so one of the things that we tend to do is we tend to look at a person's diet. And we are not necessarily going to diagnose you with irritable bowel syndrome if what's really going on is you're eating foods that don't work for you. And we have a much broader definition of what it means for foods to not work for you. So somebody might get diagnosed with irritable bowel syndrome when what's really going on is they have terrible lactose intolerance. Nobody's bothered to diagnose them. They might also have a gluten intolerance and nobody's bothered to diagnose them. And so when you go see a naturopathic physician is going to talk to you about your foods. And what I tend to do is I will test somebody with blood tests, as long as their insurance covers it and or they don't mind paying for it, for celiac disease and gluten intolerance. I'll test you for your gliadin antibodies and your tissue transglutaminase antibodies. Tissue transglutaminase are the antibodies that are active in the brush border of your small intestine. And those are the antibodies that are going to cause the inflammation and flattening of the villi, the protrusions where you absorb your food. And I'll also test gliadin antibodies, which show up in your blood. And those are antibodies that your body is directly making to proteins in gluten. And so people will come in diagnosed with irritable bowel syndrome. And a lot of the times they're eating processed food. They're eating too much sugar, too much starch and sugar. They're eating gluten and they're eating dairy. And if you have them stop that, it gets better. And so one of the things we do with irritable bowel syndrome is before we necessarily even test for food intolerances, shout out to Jillian Zarnotita, the big bullies. We talk about the big bullies. Big bullies being processed food, sugar, alcohol, caffeine, gluten, dairy, grains, and GMOs. And we talk to people about those things. We don't necessarily say you must avoid all of those foods yesterday. We may say to you, why don't you try this one or that one? Or you may have a suspicion that you're overeating one of them and then you pull it out and you feel better. I've had people pull out just gluten or just dairy or just coffee and have their bowel symptoms get much, much better. If you pull one out and you don't have a lot of difference, that doesn't mean put that one back in. Because in order to know, because sometimes it's more than one thing, and frequently it's more than one thing. And that's why sometimes it's a good idea to do a complete food allergy panel so people have a piece of paper in front of them and go, oh, I have to take care of these and these. And frequently when people are symptomatic, wheat and or gluten and dairy come up. That's probably the most frequent thing that I see. Unfortunately, so, you know, and people love to eat their cheese and their ice cream and drink their milk, and people love to eat their bread. It's a big staple. So how we, um, So how we work with you, there are different things that seem to cause it. As I said, people tend to eat foods that don't work for them. What I notice about people with irritable bowel syndrome is they're usually not always, but usually there is an emotional component, and that makes a lot of sense because you have all of the same neurons and neurotransmitters in your central nervous system that you do in your gastrointestinal system. So, for example, when you have anxiety and depression have some level of mediation by the neurotransmitter serotonin as well as dopamine. And there are definitely serotonin and dopamine receptors in your digestive system. So, and you produce and secrete those neurotransmitters from both locations. They're produced, they're secreted, they're used in both of those locations. So if you're upset about something, and it can be anything, it can be you're stressed about, a pandemic. You can be stressed about your job. You can be stressed about a relationship. And so if you tend towards irritable bowel syndrome, you can get stressed about something and then you'll get symptoms. The other thing that can happen is that you'll get something going on in your digestive system. So, for example, you eat a food that doesn't work for you. So you'll drink a cup of coffee, or you'll have gluten when you shouldn't be, or you'll consume dairy when you shouldn't be. And then you become symptomatic. And that can cause you to become anxious or depressed, because then you start kicking out or rearranging or disordering the neurotransmitters in your digestive system. And then you overproduce or underproduce those neurotransmitters. And that affects what's going on in your brain. So your brain and your digestive system are integrally connected. We also know that when you have irritable bowel syndrome, you may have a disorder of the gut flora, that the wonderful bacteria, you have bacteria, funguses, viruses, you have all kinds of things living in your digestive system. And depending on the predominance of varying bacteria, that can affect your mood and that can affect how well your digestive system functions. So if you have a preponderance of not so healthful bacteria, you're going to be more symptomatic. And in fact, if you eat foods that don't work for you, very simply, when they go through, they get to your small intestine. Your small intestine looks at them and goes, I can't do a lot with this. Or they get to your small intestine and you shoot out inflammatory compounds. And now your small intestine doesn't function well to absorb that food. That food passes through your small intestine, mostly undigested. And one of the things that people with irritable bowel syndrome will see is they'll see undigested food in their stool when they're symptomatic. And so when it gets to your large intestine, it's partially digested. And in your large intestine, you're not going to do a lot of digesting in your large intestine. Your large intestine is for, if anything helps to break down your food further, it's going to be gut flora. But you don't have enzymes and, you don't have brush border enzymes, and you don't have actual digestion going on by you in the large intestine. Any digestion that's happening is happening by flora. So if your food is only partially digested and it gets through in that state, then you're going to have flora that's going to be down there. It's going to say, hey, you're not going to eat this. I'll eat it. And you'll get an overgrowth of bacteria that don't necessarily make you feel well. It's like having incomplete combustion in a car. And what happens when you have incomplete combustion in a car? The exhaust doesn't smell so good.
It smells like, it smells like sulfur.
Yes.
Yeah.
In a car.
In a car.
So it smells like that. That's so interesting.
Which also smells like sulfur in your body.
Yes, that's right.
Interesting.
Right. And now, mind you, everybody has gas. It is normal to have flatulence. Everybody has some flatulence. And if you don't, it's a problem, believe it or not. You're supposed to belch and you're supposed to pass gas. That's normal. Why is that normal? Because the first thing that happens is when you swallow food, you swallow air. You always swallow air. If you consume any carbonated beverage, you're going to swallow some carbonation there. So you're going to need to belch that out. And what you don't belch is going to come out the other end. The other thing that's going on is as you're digesting your food, you're having metabolism go on. Some of the byproducts of metabolism is gas. And when it gets into your large intestine, there's a lot of gut flora. So the gut flora, again, are going to ferment whatever's in there, and you're going to get gas from that. If you get excessive amounts of gas, it's probably because you're not digesting your food well, and once it gets to your large intestine, you're going to have flora that's going to get down there and start working on the partially digested food, and that's going to produce various gases. So when you produce carbon dioxide gas is a byproduct of carbohydrate digestion. Straight up carbohydrates have no sulfur in them. That's why people talk about methane. Oh, methane stinks. No, it doesn't. Methane is CH3. It's got one carbon and three hydrogens. When you talk about methane coming out of the swamp, methane doesn't smell. When you smell swamp gas, what you're smelling is hydrogen sulfide. And when you have breakdown of any food that has sulfur in it, one of the breakdown products of any sulfur-containing compound is going to be hydrogen sulfide. So when you pass gas and it smells, that's what's in it. So if you eat anything with sulfur in it, say eggs or any kind of plant that has sulfur in it, like your lily family, your onions and garlic, they all have sulfur in them. And, you know, and all of your brassica, all the Brassicaceae family, your mustard family, they all have sulfur in them. So when you eat those things, you're going to have sulfur gas. And if you eat any animal protein, that's going to have sulfur in it as well. So some of your breakdown, and to have a reasonable amount of gas that you pass regularly without discomfort is absolutely normal. Not only is it normal, they don't let you out of the hospital till you do it, right?
Right.
So because they want to know
I know that one.
Because they want to know that your digestive system is functioning. And so it's perfectly fine. But if you have an excessive amount to the point where your belly is distended and you have pain, then you're probably eating things that are not working for you, and you might get that diagnosis, IBS. So things that tend to help irritable bowel syndrome, if you get regular exercise tends to settle down your digestive system. Now, when you were symptomatic, Ron, when you would get exercise, you would feel better, right?
Much.
Yeah.
Much, much better.
Even when you're eating gluten and shouldn't have been.
That's correct.
You would still feel better. And yet eating the gluten still didn't help you.
No.
So caffeine can be too stimulating to your intestines. If you have a lot of bowel irritability, caffeine overstimulates the intestines. What does it do? It just speeds things up. One of the things, if you want to digest your food well, one of the things that needs to happen is you need to be calm. The digestive system functions well when you're in parasympathetic tone. So you have your autonomic nervous system, which is your involuntary nervous system, and your autonomic nervous system is divided into fight or flight and rest and digest. So when you have fight or flight hormones up, that's going to be your dopamine, your epinephrine, your norepinephrine. You're going to be hyped up. You're going to be ready for action, ready to run away from the bear, or ready to get done whatever stressful thing that you need to get done. When you are in rest and digest, you're going to be a lot calmer. You're going to salivate more. You're going to make more digestive juices, and you're going to be able to effectively digest your food more. So overall, the calmer you are, the better your digestion is going to be. One of the treatments for irritable bowel or any problem with your digestion is rest, is chilling out, is dealing with anxiety and depression. Being calm is one of the best ways to have good digestion. And so that's one of the things to work on. So understand that doing restorative activities, meditating or getting exercise or being in nature or laughing with a friend or all those wonderful things that you do to feel calmer, doing yoga, doing Tai Chi, doing any kind of spiritual practice, anything at all that helps you to feel calmer, anything that lowers cortisol will improve your digestion. So if you have digestive symptoms, being calmer, doing restorative activities is a treatment. It's not just, oh, it's a good thing to do. It literally treats digestive symptoms. So you may find that you have to eat smaller meals. One of the things that happens with people who get a lot of gas is they have what we call easy satiety. They get full more quickly, probably because their bellies are distended. So you could eat the smaller meals, but my feeling is it's a good idea to figure out what you're eating and figure out what really works for you. You can actually take probiotics, and which probiotics to take can vary. When people have acute symptoms of irritable bowel syndrome or any kind of digestive symptom, one of the things I like to offer them is Lactobacillus rhamnosus or Lactobacillus GG. That's one species that's gentle and it seems to calm things down. I do ultimately like people to take a more broad spectrum probiotic where it has a lot of different species in it. And I have become a fan of spore probiotics. Spore probiotics are nice because they're in the spore form. They open up and wake up when they get into your digestive system. They're heat stable, so you don't have to put them in the refrigerator. And you can get them in many different species, and they do lovely things for you. So there are foods that you're supposed to avoid when you have IBS. The big thing is to figure out which ones they are. Like I said, the big bullies are a big one, that processed food, sugar, alcohol, caffeine, too much caffeine, dairy, gluten, and GMOs, grains. Some people, when they eat genetically modified versions of the same foods, they will have digestive symptoms where they won't if they're not genetically modified. So some people will be symptomatic with genetically modified corn and not with organic corn. So that is something to explore. And so there are different ways that we treat it. Well, so if somebody comes in to me with those symptoms, the first thing I'm going to do is try to help them figure out what they're eating that is not working for them. And if we go through the big bullies and the big bullies don't quite do it, then I'm probably going to offer them some kind of food allergy testing, depending on their symptoms. And we talked about food allergies, a week or two ago. In terms of food allergies, if the person tends to have a lot of inflammation, so they have a lot of respiratory inflammation, they have asthma, or they have eczema, or they tend to get hives from eating certain foods. I might test them for IgE food allergies. And so IgE is usually covered by your insurance. And it's the kind of allergy that potentially can cause hives and can cause what we call anaphylaxis. That's basically when you get hives in your respiratory tract. And so it's life-threatening. And if you get anaphylaxis or you get hives from eating any food, you should be carrying an EpiPen with you. The reason you carry an EpiPen is because you want to cause those passages that are constricting to open up, and the epinephrine will help you help things to dilate so that you can breathe again. And so IgE allergies would be the first one to go. I won't necessarily go there first if the person doesn't have that level of inflammation. If they're like, no, I don't really have respiratory allergies. No, I don't have asthma. No, I've never had eczema. I may not go there first. I may recommend that they do IgG food allergy testing. Now, the ALCAT testing there's actually been a study on ALCAT testing. And ALCAT is a form of testing that tests lymphocytes for reactivity to certain foods in test tubes, and it sees if you make IgG antibodies to certain foods, but it's specifically a lymphocyte response. It's not exactly the same as straight up IgG food allergy testing. Because with IgG food allergy testing, you're looking for levels of the IgG. With the ALCAT testing, you're actually taking food samples and reacting them with the person's lymphocytes and seeing how they respond. And so they're a little bit different, but they can give you similar results. And that ALCAT testing, it can give you really good information. And there was a study that showed that people who followed the recommendations of the ALCAT testing had relief. They had better, they had improvement of their symptoms. There are IgG food allergy panels that you can get that are not ALCAT, that are just measuring the levels of IgG in your blood. And those can be pretty economical. You can find them online yourself, and your friendly naturopathic physician or functional medicine doctor can provide you with various companies that will do those for you. They are generally not covered by insurance, but because of that, you tend to be able to get big panels for a nominal fee. So they can be very worth doing. And I do see when people do those kinds of food allergy testing, they'll find they're frequently they'll find out that they have a problem with some level of dairy in wheat. That frequently comes up regardless of the company. Most people come up who are symptomatic. They do come up with some kind of a problem with wheat and or gluten and some kind of dairy, whether it's straight up milk or casein or a particular kind of cheese. And when they come up for dairy, they generally don't come up with just one kind of dairy. It'll come up for cow's milk. It'll come up for It'll come up for cheese. It'll come up for yogurt. There'll be several that are positive. And so when I see that, I say, you know, if it's just one, anyway, if somebody is symptomatic and they get the list, I'm like, you know what? If you can manage it, you should avoid the list for 2 weeks, if not a month. A month is better than 2 weeks. And so I will see outliers. I'll see strange things come up, like the person will say, I don't eat seafood, and they'll come up for crabs or clams. That's not unusual. And I will tell you that frequently people do not come up for animal protein, that when I see that it's unusual to see people come up for animal protein. So people who want to be vegetarians, they think they're doing themselves a favor by being vegetarian. Mm. Animal protein in general, whether it's beef or pork or chicken or turkey or usually fish. Fish is more likely to come up. And when fish comes up, it's usually shellfish or crustaceans like your lobster and your shrimp. But it's actually even that is unusual. Like if something comes up, it'll be one or two things. And it's usually a shellfish or a crustacean. Like I see somebody come up for crab and I'll say to them, so do you eat a lot of crab? And they're like, no. And it's just they have an antigen that comes up that looks like it and that gets tested. And they said, I said, do you plan to eat crab? And they're like, no. You know, it just comes up sometimes.
Maybe they just don't like it. And that's why.
Their body encountered a protein that looked like crab protein at some point, or they got it as an additive in a food, and their body made an antibody to it. That's something that can happen. But just so you know, and I'm not saying if you're a vegetarian and you want to remain a vegetarian, I would certainly guide you through that and help you to stay a vegetarian in a way that worked for you. But we do find that animal protein tends to be pretty hypoallergenic. Not necessarily true of eggs, when people do come up for egg yolks and egg whites with more frequency than they do with animal protein, which is why some companies have come up. Now you can get bone broth protein. You can get, it used to be that you just had to make your own bone broth, but now you can get commercially available bone broth protein in a tub that you can just scoop out and have in your protein shake. And you'd think that that would be gross, right? It is not. If you get chocolate bone broth protein, or I have a patient who got the banana bone broth protein, she loves it. And it's really good. Yeah, it's really good. It's very fat. It's got some fat in it, and it's creamy, and it's got protein in it, so it tastes good. And the other thing I've seen is very hypoallergenic beef protein. So you can get beef protein in a tub once again and have that as a protein supplement. And it's offered by supplement companies as a very hypoallergenic protein. Because if you get into grain proteins or nut proteins and even pea protein tends to be pretty hypoallergenic because people don't tend to overeat it through the course of their lives. But I've had some people come up allergic to peas, and that can happen over time if you're a vegetarian and you're relying on pea protein as your source of protein. Because pea protein, when you get certain bars, if you get a vegetarian protein bar, frequently the protein that they put in is pea protein because it's cheap and it tends to be hypoallergenic and it's easy to add and it tastes pretty neutral. So you can put pea protein in with vanilla or chocolate or some other flavor and it doesn't contribute too much to the taste of the protein bar. So people find it palatable. And yet some people come up allergic to it. So that's an interesting thing. When you see food allergy testing, you'll get gluten and you'll get dairy. A lot of times I'll see people are allergic to yeast, where they're having an IgG response to yeast, and it will often be baker's and or brewer's yeast. So that means if you're drinking beer, you're upsetting your tummy. And if you're drinking fermented baked goods, if you're eating bread, it may be the yeast, not the grain. And it's probably both. But when I see that, I have people, I suggest to people, if you're going to eat bread, it has to be a bread that doesn't have yeast in it. And if they're also allergic to gluten, then they have to get a gluten-free bread that has no yeast in it. So they're left with having to do, if they want to do something bready still, and they find a level of grains or even nuts that they can have a flour that they can make into some kind of a baked good, then you're looking at quick breads and muffins and scones and things like that. So that's something you can get. And that's not necessarily going to have yeast in it. It's going to have baking powder, baking soda in it. So if you can tolerate that, then you might. So this is an issue where you're actually making antibodies to the yeast. The yeast is causing inflammation. And if you're making antibodies to the yeast, which are going to be the Saccharomyces species, and Saccharomyces cerevisiae, that's the species. If you're making antibodies to that, you may be also making antibodies to Candida. And if you back off on the things that have those yeasts in it, you may settle down your digestive symptoms. So, So when they give medications for irritable bowel syndrome, my thing about irritable bowel syndrome medication is you can take it if you want to, but it usually responds so much better to lifestyle. This is where you really kind of have to suck it up and figure out your diet and figure out your stress, because the drugs can only do so much. And if you need to take a drug at times and it does help you, of course you can do that, but it really is a band-aid. This is not, when you're talking about somebody has digestive upset, in naturopathic medicine, you're really going back to treating the cause. What is the cause? You're probably eating a food that isn't working for you. You may have a nutrient, you may have dysbiosis, you have gut floras out of balance. Mind you, there is irritable bowel syndrome that occurs after a viral infection where people had no symptoms at all. Then they get a viral infection, they get a viral enteritis, an inflammatory condition from having a virus. And then they have symptoms of irritable bowel syndrome afterward. And so sometimes when that happens, I will treat them with antimicrobials because they've probably gotten a dysbiosis. Their gut flora has gone out of balance because they had that inflammation. So I'll help to clean them out with herbs to settle down their inflammation. And one of the things I like to give berberines. So berberines are extracts of plants that have berberines in them. So golden seal has berberines, and berberis and mahonia. Berberis in the berberis genus. So Oregon grape has berberines in it. So does coptis, which is golden thread. That's commonly used in Chinese medicine. So, and when you get berberines, often it'll be extracted from Oregon grape, because Oregon grape is very plentiful and cheap and easy to find. Golden seal has been endangered in various years. I also like to use oregano oil just as a general, let's settle down things that are going on in your digestive system. And so that's going to help to set up. And then there's something called Robert's formula that I like to use, that tends to settle things down. Robert's formula is really nice because it's got soothing herbs in it, like slippery elm. And sometimes it can have aloe in it, and marshmallow root. And it'll also have geranium, which is an astringent, and it can have echinacea golden seal. So depending who's making the Robert's formula, there'll be some variations on it. But there was an herbalist named Robert who put that formula together, you know, a few hundred years ago. Anyway, so Robert's formula also will have either cabbage or bromelain in it, or it'll have some glutamine in it. Cabbage is high in glutamine. So when you have cabbage soup or cabbage juice, you can help heal your ulcers, because glutamine is a very important healing neurotransmitter or amino acid for your digestive system. And bromelain might be in there. So bromelain is enzyme from pineapple, and that's a proteolytic enzyme that has a lot of lovely powers in our body. It can help to break down proteins that are in unfriendly bacteria, and it can help to break down proteins that are causing inflammation. It's a very nice added ingredient. The drugs that tend to be used, you might get anti-constipation drugs, and the anti-constipation drugs can have side effects to them. You can also be given tricyclic antidepressants. They can give you, there's linaclotide and lobeprostone. Those are two newer drugs that have been given. I'm nervous about those because they can have some side effects. They can push your digestive system too much and cause more symptoms. So, and then some people need to take those when they have severe constipation. But I like to try to help with more functional approaches. If you want to know what the cause is, people tend to be predisposed to this. So if you're predisposed to it, you may have a genetic predisposition to having difficult serotonin function, because like we said, what can come along with difficult serotonin function can be psychiatric issues. So if you have anxiety or depression, that can also lead to having irritability in your digestive system. So if that system just doesn't quite work right in your body in general, then you could have more digestive upset. And so you have to work on settling down your serotonin system, which again is going to eating the right foods and spending a lot of time with stress reduction. You can have a gluten intolerance that's not enough to be diagnosed as celiac disease. You can have non-celiac gluten intolerance. You can have food intolerances that you're eating, foods that just don't work for your body. And you can also have just your digestive system. The muscles and the nerves in your digestive system are just crabby. That's just how you roll. And if you you have to work on those. And people can be triggered. So people can be triggered by eating various foods, and people can also be triggered by emotional upset. Working on your stress level is absolutely key. Some people, IBS can affect a person's weight. If they have enough problems with digestion, they can lose weight just from having so much digestive upset, especially if they have frequent diarrhea. And if you have frequent diarrhea, of course, you have to manage the diarrhea. So if you have a lot of diarrhea, one of the ways to help, now again, managing your food intolerances and managing your stress is the key thing to do. But if you have acute diarrhea, there are things you can do for that. One of them is, if diarrhea is one of your symptoms, having ground flax seeds or chia seeds ongoing can help to bulk up your stool and give you more regular contractions. I really like to use magnesium for people who have irritable bowel syndrome, whether they're anxious or depressed, and whether they have constipation or diarrhea. People tend to be magnesium insufficient in this country, or magnesium deficient in this country. Why? Because magnesium, it's very easy to not get enough magnesium if you're eating too much white food. So if you're not eating foods that are green, or you're not eating fruits and vegetables, you're going to get plenty of magnesium if you eat green vegetables, because the magnesium is the central molecule in chlorophyll. Well, it's a central atom in chlorophyll. And so anything with chlorophyll in it is going to give you magnesium. And if you eat a lot of greens all the time, or a lot of green vegetables, you're going to have a lot more magnesium. Now, some people will say, well, if my bowel is irritable, I can't eat vegetables because they hurt me, because that level of fiber really bothers them.
I know that.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. And so we find that if you can help somebody settle their digestion down and take and eliminate the foods that are not working for them, they can go back to eating vegetables. But if you're still in bad shape, If you're still having symptoms, then we'd like to give you magnesium. And the nice thing that magnesium will do for you is it'll help you to have more regular bowel contractions. So if you're constipated, it will help you to have more regular peristalsis to get the stool moving through your body. And if you have diarrhea, same thing. You're going to have more spasticity and more irritability. So it'll help to calm things down as well. So if you take too much magnesium, it can give you more watery stool and you'll have more release of stool and it can increase your diarrhea. But if you're constipated, it can draw water to it and help you have more bowel movements. That's why with diarrhea, you have to get the dose of magnesium right because you don't want to aggravate the diarrhea, but you want to calm the spasticity of your colon. So there are some things you can use. The other things we might use things that calm the digestive system. So one of the things we use, we might actually give somebody peppermint. Now, the thing with peppermint that you have to be careful of is peppermint is very calming to the digestive system. It can also be calming to your lower esophageal sphincter. And lower esophageal sphincter is the ring of muscle that separates the esophagus from your stomach. And if that's too relaxed, you can get reflux. So and I know for me, if I do too much peppermint, that's something that happens to me. So I have to be careful. Even though I enjoy peppermint, I drinking peppermint tea, I wouldn't do that. It gives me some stomach upset because once it gets into your stomach, it'll calm your stomach down. And once it gets into your small intestine and your large intestine, it will tend to calm things down. But it can calm down that lower esophageal sphincter. So what do we do about that? One of the things we'll do is we'll give enterically coated peppermint. We'll give peppermint pills that have a coating in it that makes it so it doesn't break down till it gets into your small intestine. So it bypasses the stomach, doesn't open up in the stomach, so it doesn't give you more heartburn and reflux. Ginger is a great anti-inflammatory. And ginger is nice because you can absorb it into your body, but it also will go through your digestive system and it can settle your stomach right down. And it's more of an anti-inflammatory, but it doesn't necessarily relax that lower esophageal sphincter the way that the peppermint does. Chamomile can also be helpful. Chamomile is a nervine more than an anti-inflammatory. Chamomile is also really helpful for pain. And so chamomile can be really nice to calm your stomach and calm your digestive system all the way down. So those are things I like to use. So supplement wise, what we're going to tend to use is I like to use magnesium. I like to offer people nervines and if somebody is having an issue with anxiety or stress, I'm going to treat that. So I'm going to use whatever nervine is going to work for them. Chamomile is one that tends to work very nicely on the digestive system, but there are plenty of others like lemon balm and linden and motherwort and oat straw and skullcap. And so there are many nervine herbs, many things that can help calm your nerves, and things that just calm you and make you feel more relaxed are going to help your digestive system, might help your IBS. And that includes CBD. So if you were to use cannabidiol, if that calms you down, if that calms you down emotionally, it might calm your digestive system down as well, because there's cannabinoid receptors everywhere, including in your digestive system, and CBD might help your IBS as well. LBJ took the IRT, et cetera, et cetera. I know. Yeah. So, so when I met Ron, he told me I have irritable bowel syndrome. I said, really? So tell me, Ron, back in the day, how long ago was that? What was your experience of irritable bowel syndrome?
Well, it was 15 years ago.
Uh-huh.
Or more. Because we've known each other for quite some time.
Yes.
Oh, you're going to put me on camera.
Yeah, why not?
Hi. Yes, it was like 15 years ago, and I had come to a point in my life where I stopped drinking coffee because I was having so many digestive issues with it. And my two sisters told me, well, you know, they said, you're 40 now, so therefore you're going to have coffee problems because it's like happens in our family. And I wasn't real happy about it, but I gave up coffee for 10 years. Think about that, 10 years. So no coffee for 10 years. Didn't really, still having problems, lots of digestive problems. I used to have lots of problems with hemorrhoids. I used to have problems with a lot of things. And it was primarily digestive oriented. And then I met Fran, and we went out on a date. And when we were out on a date, Fran grabbed a hold of my arm and pulled it over and looked at it. And she went and she said, "You have food allergies."
Now, and if you come see me, I'm probably going to do that to you.
She's going to rub your arm. Yeah. And so I figured this was either the start of something interesting or start of something good. So we continued to be together, and we have been for a long time. As we began living together, she started to note some of the problems I was having, digestive issues I was having, running to the bathroom very quickly, etc. You know, just a lot of urgency, I would say. And then we started eliminating things out of my diet because I didn't have good insurance. And so it was best to just do the least expensive way, which is the elimination diet. And finally tracked it down to wheat was certainly a concern.
First we pulled you off dairy.
First it was dairy.
Because we thought your mother had lactose intolerance.
Right. Stay close to the mic. We took the dairy out because, well, both my sisters also had lactose intolerance. They both had it too. So it's kind of, you know, it's a little family history here, so we're watching it carefully. And then, we started just knocking different things off. And I would get a little better each time, but not a lot better. A little better, a little better, a little better. And then finally, on January 1st, the New Year's resolution was to go cold turkey, give up gluten completely, pull all sources of wheat out of my diet, and in 5 days, I was back to my old self again.
After 10 years. Yeah, because you were 50.
Right, I was 50 then. And I'm able to drink coffee, and I do eat ice cream, although there may be some issues with that, but I'm still eating ice cream. I eat vegetables like I've never eaten them before. I could not go for more than one day. If I had a big salad and the next morning I'd wake up and it would just be nightmarish because it would just rush through me, just like it did with that coffee that I was drinking. And it's all back. We eat salads every day. We eat big salads every day. We eat lots of vegetable stir fries. We do lots with vegetables now. And I just feel 100% better.
So one of the things you're hearing is that when Ron had his IBS symptoms, he couldn't eat vegetables. And my thinking is that there's some level, even though when you do the histology, when you do the a colonoscopy in somebody with irritable bowel syndrome, you don't see inflammation. There's still some level of inflammation. It's just not causing a lot of noticeable cellular damage. But if you have immune globulins that are causing inflammation in the digestive system, then you definitely have some level of inflammation. And so that you have inflammation and irritation going on. And one of the things that you have when you eat fiber, when you eat a lot of fiber, especially if you're eating a salad where everything's raw, the fiber is not distressed. So when it's going through you, one of the jobs of insoluble fiber is to scrub your intestines. One of the things that goes on is when you eat food is that your cells turn over. The cells in the lining of your intestines are basically the same kinds of cells that are in your skin. You have 7 layers of cells. You have a couple layers of columnar cells. Then you first you have basal cells. You have basal cells, the first couple layers. Then you have a few layers of columnar cells. And then you have a couple layers of squamous cells. And all the cells start out as basal cells. And then they rise up through the layers. And then they change as they go through the layers. And the last thing they are is squamous cells, which is what's on top. And then they eventually wear out. And so as they wear out, you slough them off your skin. So that's what the dust mites are eating. Mm. And when you're eating food.
Good for you for feeding those.
Yeah. And when you're eating food, fiber sloughs off the worn out the digestive cells, enterocytes. And so, and now you have enterocytes going through your small intestine. So what do you think you do with them? Well, guess what? Your proteolytic enzymes grind them up and you reuse them. You reuse the amino acids and you make new stuff. So you recycle them. And that's normal. And if you eat a lot of fiber and you have that sweeping process of the unfriendly cells or you'll sweep out a lot of unfriendly cells, and then you'll just grind them up and reuse them for other things. And so when you are able to do that, when you're able to eat a lot of fiber, you're less likely to get cancers and problems in your digestive system.
Yay.
Because you're constantly recycling your cells. People who are constipated are going to have more trouble with that.
Sure.
And people who are not eating enough fiber are going to have more trouble with that. So what you see when somebody has active inflammatory bowel syndrome, they have a level of inflammation that's not letting them eat fiber, especially if the fiber, is insoluble. They might do a little bit better with soluble fiber, but what you have to do is you have to get rid of the inflammation, and you get rid of the inflammation by figuring out which foods don't work for you and taking them out, and then also reducing your stress. So I have a request for what is the name of the food allergy test. I can't give specific names. A type of food allergy test is a procedure of testing is, as I said, ALCAT, and that's one that where they test lymphocytes against samples of foods to see how the lymphocytes respond. And then there are other food allergy tests that are IgG food allergy tests. And you can get panels of those tests online. And also, any naturopathic physician or functional medicine doc can administer them to you. So if you hook up with any practitioner like that, they'll be able to escort you through that. Just because it's community radio, I'm not supposed to say brands. So and I find those tests to be very useful because you find out what doesn't work for you. And even if something comes up that you're like, kiwi fruit, but I never eat kiwi fruit. You might be just fine with kiwi fruit. It's just that it passed through you sometime and you made an antibody to it. And your body's just like, well, you have a little bit of antibody to it and it doesn't bother you that much. And I do tell people, especially if the level, because when you get the food allergy test back, you'll tend to, you'll have some that are, you have a high level of antibodies. There'll be a scale of like 4 to 1 or 3 to 1, depending on the test that you use. And the ones, depending on what they are, I might say that's not a big deal for you. What I do tend to tell people to do, if you get a test back and it's mostly ones, it's a good idea to spend 2 weeks to a month avoiding everything, just to see what happens. And then if there are foods that you absolutely miss, now you have a list. Start one at a time by adding those foods back in and see if you get symptoms. And you don't add, you add foods in one at a time. You see if you get symptoms. If you have no symptoms, wait like 3 or 4 days and then add something else in. If you are symptomatic, then you take that food out, wait till the symptoms go away, and then try another food. So, all right. So I think I have to go. It's time to go. So that was a cool thing to talk about, food allergy testing and, you know, irritable bowel syndrome, because a lot of people have it. And I have to say that talking to somebody who deals with natural medicine, whether it's a naturopathic physician or a functional medicine doctor or an osteopath or someone who is familiar with natural medicine, it's a very good idea to go see somebody like that to help you with digestive upset, because my experience is that MDs, not all MDs, but MDs are generally going to treat your condition and they're going to give you medications for what you have. They're not necessarily going to talk about foods, because if somebody doesn't have celiac disease, they don't like to tell people to go off gluten. We will tell you to get off. If a food is hurting you, we don't want you to eat it. All right. Even if it's a healthy food, if you eat broccoli and every time you eat broccoli, you get sick, there's no reason for you to eat broccoli. All right. So we want you to find a diet that you're going to enjoy and is going to make you feel good. And with that, I'm going to go. You have been listening to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician, with my co-host Ron Meniza. You can email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, and Spotify. You can also leave questions or comments at my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at Fran Storch, ND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores and WHUS. www.ourstory.org.